The Lima Coast to Coast, Show 29, July 8th, 2006. That will should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the show, I want to remind listeners there are four ways to contact the podcast. First is via email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. The second is voicemail, 206-600-4216. The next is the website, www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. And then the fourth way is via mail, Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, 30065, and that's in the United States. On today's show, we have Keith 418 and myself talking about modeling within the Thelemic community, and then a very interesting conversation with Breck Outland regarding C.F. Russell and Breck's website exploring the C.F. Russell materials. However, before the interviews, I want to give a few reminders. First, that Thelema Coast to Coast has a MySpace page. It can be viewed at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast. Right now, there are over 600 people who have friended it, and if you have a MySpace page, feel free to stop over and friend on it. That way you can get updates on what's going on with Thelema Coast to Coast. Also, I still have Thelema Coast to Coast bumper stickers, and all you have to do is send a postcard to the mail address, include your return address, and I will send you a couple of Thelema Coast to Coast bumper stickers. And the postcard will also be scanned and put on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Lastly, the Thelema Coast to Coast Frapper map has over 260 people on it now, but I know there are a lot more listening, so please go to the Thelema Coast to Coast Frapper map. It can be found off the Thelema Coast to Coast website or on the MySpace page, and add yourself. It's great to see who's listening and where you're from. Now, without it appearing as a shameless self-promotion, I want to let everybody know in the Atlanta area that I will be giving a talk on the night of July 14th at 8 p.m. at Dove and Serpent Oasis in coordination with Hagia Sophia Chapter of Rose Croix. I will be talking about Aleister Crowley and his ontology. The name of the talk is The Nature of Becoming, an examination of Aleister Crowley's ontology and map of consciousness. I'm hoping to be able to record this talk and put it out on the podcast later in the summer. We'll see how that goes. However, if you want to hear it now, there's also a reception, music, wonderful food, wine, and things like that. So I would encourage everybody in the Atlanta area who listens to the podcast to attend. It is again at Dove and Serpent Oasis on July 14th at 8 p.m. If you have questions, feel free to email the podcast and I will forward them to the appropriate people. The cost of the event is $11. So, one other thing people should be aware of, I've been having some problems with my hosting. The Thelema Coast to Coast website has been on a server run over my DSL line. I have some servers in my home. However, this has been unreliable the last week or so, and that has resulted in the website and email being down occasionally. I have since moved the website to a third-party hosted server, so hopefully the website will be more reliable as well as faster. I've tested it, and things seem to be functioning fine. However, if you have any problems, please email me. Okay, so now we're going to get into listener feedback. The first one is a audio feedback message from Stephen Ash in the UK. I recently interviewed Stephen about his book, The Kabbalah of the 50 Gates, and his take on Kabbalah and the organization he's in. That will be on a future show. But here is Steve's feedback regarding show 28.
93, John. Stephen Ash here, calling from Glastonbury in England. I'm now a regular listener, and I'm looking forward to the broadcasting of our interview that we recorded last week, giving me the opportunity of reaching deeply within to myself and attempting to express my convictions related to the esoteric path. Also, thank you for working your online initiative. The Lima Coast to Coast is excellent. It enables such a forum for the open sharing of ideas and opinions. I'd like to take a few moments to share some thoughts I've had concerning Keith 418's take on the initiate's conversion crisis, which you discussed in issue 28, which concerns the moment of cusp between everyday consciousness and the privilege perspective brought on by that flash of enlightenment, that aha moment of realization of the first glimpse of the true will involved in the state of becoming initiate. I'm of the opinion that what we're talking about here is the impact upon the everyday functioning of any individual who's realized that the world can be seen in a different way after a moment of insightful revelation that transforms his or her point of view forever. The main comment I'd like to make about this is that both yourself and Keith 418 express something of a philosophical dilemma when addressing the issue of acting in accordance with one's true will in both the public and the private arenas. You both intimate that the task is something of a struggle, which indeed it always is, life being an art that arises from the very nature of struggle on both the tertiary and existential levels. But I'm sure that a way of looking at this situation can be resolved if we remember to temper our perspective on the challenges of remaining true to one's core of will with the kind of insightful perspective recently arrived at in the area of the physical sciences. In the same way as physicists adopt such apparently contradictory models of fundamental theory as the classical Newtonian model and the diversely complex theories of quantum electrodynamics to base their math upon, I feel that we have to bring the same perspective to bear on the praxis of Thelema. Look at the way in which the properties of light have been treated in each of these schools. Classical physics deals with wave and particle behavior in what we esotericists term the microcosm, that is, everything that occurs on this side of the light speed barrier. Now, the classic model of relativity doesn't say that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. It merely states that nothing can cross the light speed time barrier. Everything has a linear development here in our everyday reality, but on the subatomic level, the energy exchanges of photons, which are emitted from electrons, behave as if they have properties that travel backwards in time to interact with that aspect of the photon operating in our continuum, the microcosm. There's an experiment known as the double slit experiment, and there's a nice video clip of this 5-minute download on whatthebeep.com websites listed on Google. The quantum physicists adopt a much broader model and incorporate the possibility that interaction is possible on either side of the light speed barrier, and this is why certain particles seem to be there one moment, gone again, before popping back into existence. What I'm edging towards saying here is that we shouldn't be afraid of recognizing that the issues of self-honesty or gaining the perspective of self-directed will in the widely diverse world of our outer reality and the universe composed of the combination of every other individual's shared outer reality maps can be addressed on at least two different levels. We can legitimately adopt an approach based on apparently irreconcilable strategies of theoretical modeling, as long as we recognize that all the rules are relativistic. That is, relative to our individual capacity or the quality of our capacity of understanding. Understanding comes first, remember, wisdom follows. The approach we might take to the greater universe around us can be based on a different modelling system to the universe of our inner reality. The math will be the same. I love listening to the quality of ideas showcased on your show, and even though I'm only a single brother of the Argentium Astrum, I do cherish the community you're so successfully building there. In this community, disagreement, agreement, debate can all play a part in improving the quality of our experience of an unfolding Thelemic tradition. On behalf of everyone here in the Fraternity of the Sanctum Regnum, from myself and to all my brothers and sisters in the Argentium Astrum, my best wishes, and do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. 93, everyone.
Thanks for sending that in, Steve. It's always interesting to get different perspectives on various aspects of the thalamic process. And I appreciate you taking the time to send that in. The next email is from a listener named Shade. 93 John, in reference to your 8th, 9th, 10th podcast presenting the audio version of Liber All, I was wondering if there is available a full audio version of all three chapters of Liber All via MP3. I really enjoyed the third chapter with the music playing in the background. Did that group do the entire Book of the Law or just chapter 3? If they did, I would definitely love to have a copy of it. Let me know. Thanks. Shade, loves the law, love under will. Okay, the first chapter was from a set of three recordings that were done in the early 90s. As I mentioned before, Steve Ash was part of that, and that's how I got in touch with him at first. He has since done a recording of Liber All, and I gave some samples of that. That is really the best recording that I know of all three chapters. The one that was done in the 90s is really poor quality. I wanted to still kind of use that sound in the first chapter, but I understand that the quality wasn't the best. So if you're looking to get all three chapters, Steve's is the best to get. The second chapter was done by John Sewell and a group of Thelemites in Seattle, and he did just the second chapter. And then the reading of the third chapter was done by a group of musicians, and they have only done chapter 3 at this point. So if you're looking for all three chapters spoken, Steve Ash's is the way to go. If you're looking for all of them put to music, unfortunately, I don't know of anybody who has all three chapters to music. I hope that answers your question. The next email is from a listener named Tony. He writes, "Hi John, greetings and health. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. I came across your podcast via an email sent to a Yahoo Groups list that I belong to. To be perfectly honest with you, I was intrigued by the title Thelema Coast to Coast and wondered what sort of podcast would be published under a name which, well, forgive me for saying this, but sounded kind of commercial. I have to say that the first podcast I listened to, number 25, blew me away. So much so that I have downloaded them all and have started to listen through them from the beginning. So congratulations on what is a thoroughly professional and diverse offering. The interview with Tony Stansfeld-Jones was absolutely fascinating and a breath of fresh air from the normal interviews which dwell on a person's magical life. I so agree that it is important to learn as much as we can about the leading lights in occult and magic, both their magical and personal sides. Maybe some would consider this prying, but I consider it more like something akin to balance, if that makes any kind of sense. I belong to a ceremonial magic order several years, which, unfortunately, went the way of many small orders and broke up. Now, I find it interesting to hear your and Keith 418's discussion on self-discipline, as I realize this was the reason the order broke up. But the point I really want to make here is that my magical life has drifted very much into the theoretical and the practical and has fell into dispute. However, your podcasts have reawakened my interest, and I have restarted the practical and also decided to join the OTO. Something I've been considering very seriously for some time. For information, I include links to Thelema Coast to Coast on my website. I will also be including links to Thelema Coast to Coast in the next issue of an email newsletter I send out to around 800 people. Keep up the good work. In regards to Keith 418. Love the law, love under will. Tony in Essex, England. Well, thank you, Tony. I appreciate that. For those who haven't heard the interview with Tony Stansfeld-Jones, it was one of the first ones. I think it's number 4 or number 5. And it is an interview with the son of Freder Akkad. And the important aspect of it is Crowley's diaries really talk about all the facets of his life, from the personal to the family to his magical and so forth. But Freder Akkad's diaries were pretty much mostly his magical workings, and so you didn't get a lot of his life. The interview with Tony allows us to kind of know a little more about what the home life of Freder Akkad was like. And so the questions might seem mundane, but they actually kind of open up a lot of information about how Freder Akkad lived his life, and how someone who is so important within the Thelemic history and community, it's interesting to see how he lived his life on a day-to-day basis and still be able to come up with the accomplishments that he did. So that's why that interview with Tony Stansfeld-Jones is pretty interesting. And Tony, I'm glad that you're interested in going to be joining the OTO. For all the criticism that I and others on the show give of the OTO, I'm happy to be a member, and I support the OTO and the work that it does. And so I'm glad that you find it interesting. It's far from perfect. It certainly has a lot of problems, and I and others are working to bring those problems to light. But it certainly is something worthwhile, and I'm glad you and many of the other listeners who have contacted me and let me know that you're going to be joining the OTO, somewhat influenced because of the podcast. I really appreciate that. Okay, the last listener feedback is a bit different. Over the last month or two, I've been getting some voicemails from someone in South Georgia. He is an associate pastor of a church in South Georgia, and he has been calling and leaving feedback. I haven't been playing any of those, but since he's left me about four so far, I figured I would put one on, and you all let me know what you think. So here is Zebulon Wilcox of the Poplar Creek Church of God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost.
Zebulon Wilcox here, Associate Pastor, Reverend, the Pop Creature to God, using the Holy Ghost down here in Boomer, Georgia. Here's the thing, you dark-sided Satanist. Hey, this podcast 28's done taking the cake. You understand? Taking the cake. Talking about what is this? The Lemic conversion, so-called? What is this? Satanic conversion, brothers? Why, you wondering why it's hard for people to turn over to the dark side? To become Satanists? A whole show about why it's hard to become a Satanist. Why don't people want to become a Satanist? Oh, it's hard for people to become a Satanist, to turn away from their Christianity. You understand? Because it's dark-sided, brother. Why do you think? And I think you know that, and I think you're just mocking people. Also, here's the thing, in the other part of the podcast, you got a satanic preacher on there, talking about it's hard to become a preacher, talking about you got to go to school to become a preacher and all this. Not if you're Rufus T. Cash, Pastor Reverend, Public Church of God using the Holy Ghost. He was called, brother. You ain't nothing to talk about getting called. Who was this? It's just the most dark sided show I've ever heard in my life. You understand? Talking about satanic conversion. Well, I got some kind of conversion for you, brother. It's called Jesus Christ. Talking about the blood of Jesus Christ washing away all your sins, brother. And that's what I'm offering your listeners right now, brother. A real conversion. You understand? A real conversion in Christ. Now, here's the thing. This is a cease and desist. Brother from Papa Creatures, God using the Holy Ghost, quit this dark-sided podcast or we will go Old Testament on your ass. Understand? Thank you.
Well, I don't think we'd want you to get Old Testament on our ass, but your voicemail is interesting nonetheless. I am interested in what people think about Mr. Wilcox, and send me some feedback about him and his voicemail. Anyway, let's move on to the interview with Keith 418, and we'll be talking about modeling within the Thelemic community.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John, thanks for having me.
We've been getting a lot of feedback about Show 28. It seems many people really like the comments that you said there. But I want to change it and kind of look, instead of the Thelemic conversion, I want to look at the modeling that goes on within the Thelemic community, because people don't see the conversion experiences, so they don't end up having them themselves. They don't see the leaders leading. They don't see them engaging in the material. They don't see a lot of these things. So they're not modeled, so they don't know to expect them. Can you touch a little bit on modeling?
Well, often we hear the response to any sort of criticism is, well, you need to model the behavior that you want to see, which, of course, throws back the onus of responsibility onto the person making the criticism. And in many instances, that's very valid, and that's a very good way to sort of check people who are being hypocritical and are asking others to do work that they're not willing to do themselves. But it opens up certain other problems for the people insisting on modeling as being the major solution, which is, if there are problems that we see existing within the community, problems that they see as well, then we have to ask ourselves, who's modeling those problems? And oftentimes, you know, I think that what we're really looking at is that people are following what the leaders want them to do or what the leaders are doing, whether it's what the leaders want or not explicitly, but they're following the model of the leaders. And if the leaders are used to, for example, foisting responsibility on problems off onto others, then everyone will follow their example and decline to take responsibility for any problem. And for example, one of the things that we see a lot is this attitude of the leaders of just, you know, stepping back and not interfering. You know, they call it the sort of Taoist process of non-interfering. Well, after a certain period of time, everyone else learns to do it too. And if they see something that's really rotten going on, or if they see a real problem, rather than stepping in and addressing it and trying to fix it, they just step back and don't take any responsibility for it. You know, you and I were talking earlier today that one of the honor codes at the Virginia Military Institute, VMI, is that the cadet will not lie, cheat, or steal, and not tolerate other people who do. And I think that's the second part of the problem that this WEMA community as a whole is really struggling with. Individuals choose not to lie, to cheat, to steal, but they tolerate, they think it's dilemic to tolerate everyone else around them who is doing that. And that's where the problem comes in. You know, who's really modeling this process of endless toleration? And I think you and I have also observed that who gets tolerated and how they get tolerated is also really interesting. It's not across the board. For example, you know, if somebody has a very obnoxious, very insistent kind of critical take, you know, one that's been handed to us more than one occasion for our attitudes, you know, then that person gets censored or you know, people look down on them, depending on where the opinion is coming from. For example, if you have a very liberal, very egalitarian, very humanistic morality, and you're loud and obnoxious about it the way some of the people are in the OTO, everyone loves you. There's no criticism of your tone or your problem. You're considered an irascible character or, you know, prickly or crusty, but everyone loves you because deep down they agree with whatever agenda you happen to be pushing with your obnoxious tone. On the other hand, if you're critical of the leaders, if you're critical of the state of the community, if you look critically at what's going on, then of course your tone becomes a problem and you're censored and that's a big issue.
Well, one of the things that I find interesting is the leaders often get surprised when their poor modeling catches up with them. There have been times that things have happened that various OTO officers were aware of, but did not feed the information back up the channel to the higher leadership. Then when the leadership finds out much later, they turn around and say, "Why didn't you all tell me this?" What they don't understand is that they're responsible. Communication is both ways. If you want communication, you have to model communication.
Right. If the followers have learned not to be transparent in the same way the leaders don't want to be transparent. The leaders don't tell the followers what's going on, and then the followers turn around and they won't tell the leaders what's going on because that's what they're modeling. I mean, one of my favorite examples of this is, you know, one of the leaders came out with this really big piece about don't gossip. You know, gossiping is wrong. And I characterized the piece at the time as the sort of editorial one would expect to see in a 1950s high school newspaper written by the principal. You know, don't run in the hallways or chewing gum is bad. I mean, it's not something that you'd expect to see in a secretive, occult, advanced, on the vanguard of occult wisdom group. It was this 1950s homily about gossiping. Well, then it turned out that he wasn't getting very important information about some of the people in the group, and he was wondering, you know, why no one had ever told him this, and they turned around and said, "Hey, you know, you told us not to gossip."
Why? Because there's no other really established channels of communication. Gossip
right, as
is
long
one
as
of the ways information
right,
goes around.
Exactly, and this is what a friend of mine said. He goes, "You have to gossip in this group because no one ever tells you what's going on. It's the only way to find out what's really happening."
I was recently talking to a member of the OTO's Electoral College, and I ended up telling them that a body had lost its space almost a year before. The member of the college didn't know.
Yeah, well, again, are they really curious about it? I mean, I have a friend on the Electoral College who is very, very intent on pointing out that if you don't have the Crowley books in your house and you're not studying and reading them, and if he comes to your house and he doesn't see the occult books, you can claim all that you want that you're into Crowley and Dilema, but he's not going to believe it, because if you really were, the books would be there, you'd be looking at them, it would be important to you, and the evidence would be clear. He says this all the time. And I've turned this around on the EC and said, if you were really interested in the state of the organization, John and I would not be the ones telling you all this stuff you don't know. You'd know it already. You'd know it before we would. But well, you don't, because you're not that really interested in what's going on.
We would also not be the ones asking the questions about various kinds of data. They would be able they'd be asking the questions and giving the information before we even asked for it. And if we did ask for it, they would immediately be able to give it to us.
Of course. They haven't put the information together because they're not interested, in the same way that people don't buy the Crowley books because deep down they're not really interested in it either. And this is the weird thing, is that often the leaders are sort of modeling their own, the distance and the sort of lack of responsibility and the passing the buck mentality that the followers are. Now, you know, people could say to us, well, you need to model the sort of behavior you want to see from the members. What they often don't expect is that we think we are. We want the members to be looking critically at the organization, so we look critically at it. We want the members to be challenging the status quo, so we challenge it. We're asking the members to look critically at the leaders, so we criticize them. If we're modeling the kind of behavior we want to see.
Absolutely. Another thing that they don't understand is that when the leaders don't say anything to people, when the leaders don't come down and say that somebody's acting inappropriately or being a way that is non-congruent with the order principles, by them being aware of it and doing nothing, that is a tacit endorsement of what's going on.
Right, of course it is.
One of the stories that I point out to people is when the Olympics came to Atlanta in 1996, there's a county called Cobb County. It's where everybody's favorite Newt Gingrich and Bob Barr come from. And that county has an actual anti-homosexual stance. And when the Olympics came to Atlanta, they asked the county to drop the stance, otherwise they were going to pull the events that they had planned in Cobb County out. Cobb County refused, and the Olympics pulled the events from the county because they knew...
tacitly recognized it.
Right. If they had done the events in Cobb County, they would have been endorsing Cobb County's positions.
It's the same thing as like musicians refusing to play South Africa during the apartheid period. They refused to go there because they knew that performing in South Africa or one of their miniature pseudo-client states that they had set up within their country would be seen as a tacit endorsement of apartheid.
Exactly.
So they didn't do it. So when are our leaders demonstrating by their actions that they're not approving of certain behaviors and issues.
And this goes on for the conduct of the officers, how the space is acquired, if they have space, everything from how the dues structure is, if they have dues, everything. If the body is being supported and endorsed and tolerated by the leadership, and they are well aware of what's going on there, and they do nothing about it, that is condoning what's going on there, and that is tacit agreement.
Of course. And the other thing that you need to point out to people is that if the members don't see the leaders taking a stand and making critical comments and drawing the line, they're going to look to other people who do it. And you and I, no one would listen to us if the leaders were taking a really active, leader-like role in the organization and directing people and talking about their own experiences and admitting their mistakes and being upfront with what their plans were and telling us what we were going to need to sacrifice in order to make their goals come into reality. If they were doing all of that stuff, you and I wouldn't be, no one would listen to us. We'd be totally minimized. Our importance would be gone.
That is correct. So in the end, what ends up happening is the leaders make themselves irrelevant, and when they do come out every now and then and strongly encourage somebody to do something, it falls short and people ignore it.
Right, and they're not seen as being really in touch or having a relevant position any longer, and I think that's very sad. The leaders sometimes make this out to be that this is how they're empowering people. By stepping back and letting people make their own decisions, they're empowering them. Unfortunately, you know, this sort of reminds me of when I was a kid in school, when the children had entered a classroom and weren't settling down to listen to the lesson, the teacher would often wait for them to, you know, come to order themselves, and then you'd be ashamed because you'd see the teacher waiting and you'd shut your friends up and the class would begin. Well, in some situations, the teacher it wouldn't work. You had to be a special kind of teacher with a special kind of nerve to get the kids to be ashamed of themselves and to make them be quiet. So some teachers their bluff would be called, the kids would keep talking and ignore the teacher, and the teacher would have to call them to attention anyway, and they would lose. And to me, the OTO often seems like a classroom where the teachers are waiting for the kids to come to order on their own volition for years. They're just standing there waiting for the class to begin, and nothing's going on.
I hear you. Well, this is a long show anyway, so I'm going to have to cut this conversation off here. But we really encourage the listeners to go out and start thinking about these things and start modeling and refusing to tolerate other people's bad modeling.
Oh, I totally agree.
Well, thanks again. 93.
93, John.
Thanks again to Keith for being on the show. I hope people are enjoying the various topics that we go over. We kind of go between practical aspects of magic, the Goetia, asanas and various libras, and then talk about some of the theoretical things and in some of the more mundane aspects of magic. Again, if magic is the manifestation of will, then it's manifesting in everything, not just in the rituals that you're doing with your robes on and in incense-filled rooms, but it's also the magic of manifesting, you know, your rent and cars and food and a job and clothes and books and things like that. So magic is totalizing. It's fully encompassing all of your life. And so that's why we talk about a lot of these things, because everything that you do ultimately should be willful and a manifestation of will. I'd like to move into the interview with Breck Outland. He has a website that has a lot of fascinating information about a student of Crowley's named C.F. Russell. Russell also started the Karanzan Club and the GBG, the Gnostic Body of God, both groups that were Thelemic, but a little different take on Thelema and Crowley's work, a lot of it based on Russell and his teachings. So Breck has been studying this material for, I think, almost a decade now, and he and some associates of his have this website that have a lot of information about Russell and Russell's material. So I wanted to have Breck on to talk about Russell and also the website. I will have a link to the website in the Thelema Coast to Coast show notes.
We have Breck Outland on the phone. Welcome to the podcast, Breck, 93.
Hi, 93, John.
Well, let's start talking about C.F. Russell in a historical manner.
Okay.
When was he born, and how did he get involved with magic and Thelema and Crowley at first?
Well, Russell was born in June of 1897, so he's actually at the beginning of the, right before the new aeon, and he spent his childhood, you know, here in the States. He's an American, went through high school and participated in his debate team in high school. He came in contact with Crowley sometime around mid-1918. He started writing to Crowley after seeing some magazine articles that Crowley had written in some of the local magazines, and Crowley started writing back to him, and they started a kind of an informal conversation over letters, you know. So it ended up that Crowley was in the United States. He was in New York, and he was working on the Equinox, and it just so happened that Russell had the first 9 volumes of the Equinox, and so Crowley asked him in a letter if he could borrow them because he needed them for reference in order to prepare the next volume. Well, that was probably the beginning of their relationship, and eventually what ended up happening was that around the... it actually happened on Russell's 21st birthday that Crowley met with Russell and initiated him into the third degree of the OTO.
Okay.
And that's when Russell took the magical motto of Ganeshtai, which is roughly translated as coming into being, or perhaps something like just becoming. And that became Russell's magical motto that he kept for the rest of his life. After that, their correspondence continued, and on July 12, 1920, Crowley wrote to Russell and asked him to join him in Cefalu at the Abbey of Thelema. Russell, in turn, wrote back to Crowley, and there was a little bit of exchange between Russell and Crowley and Russell and Leah Hersig. And eventually, by November 21st, 1920, Russell arrives in Cefalu and takes up the duties as Crowley's secretary there. 1 week after that, on November 28th, he and Leah Hersig and Crowley all participated in a work called the Cephalodium Working, which was basically a ritual that was dedicated to help A.C. produce a commentary on the Book of the Law. So during his stay in Cefalu, Russell continued to write to Thelemites that were back in the homestead in the Americas, including people like Frederick Codd and W.T. Smith, and, you know, sending them news and telling them, you know, what his duties are and how he's promoting the Law of Thelema. And he's basically trying to drum up a lot of enthusiasm, especially with his correspondence with Smith, about, you know, spreading the word of Thelema. So Russell continues to act as Crowley's secretary, transcribing the commentary on Liber Al, and, you know, taking care of all of his correspondence and all of the various writings that Crowley was doing at the time. Well, eventually, Frater Pergradier shows up at the Abbey of Thelema, and Genestai begrudgingly relinquishes his room at the Abbey to him. And right about that same time, or right after that, Russell begins his magical retirement at the Temple on the Rock on July 18th, 1921, and records his magical diaries during this period and the rituals and events that led up to his experience over the next 6 days. At the end of that time, he returned to the Abbey of Thelema and resumed his duties. Well, shortly after that, Crowley expelled the Fro sisters, Nanette and Mimi, from Cefalù along with their children, and Russell decided to leave Cefalù along with them on October 23rd of 1921. So they left for Sydney, Australia, departing from Naples, Italy. Once they were in Australia, again, Frater Pergradier shows up in Australia. That's his native land. And Russell and Pergradier exchange various experiences and talk about, you know, their time with Crowley. And Russell exchanges his copy of Crowley's Yi King versification for Bennett's copy of Liber Samec. Shortly after that, Russell ships out back to the U.S. and arrives in San Francisco around March of 1922. Once he's back in the States, Russell continues to write to Smith and Jones and some of the other people that are in the Americas and trying to hook up with them and see what's up. Russell tries to, shortly after that, persuade Smith to join in on his proposed work of the Caranzon Club, and he begins using his letterhead around March of 1922. Well, Crowley assigns Frater Akkad as Russell's superior in the AA in the U.S., and Russell continues to write to Crowley and continues under Akkad. And Akkad begins, you know, working on his Psychomagian Society and his Universal Brotherhood activities. Well, Russell decides not to join the Psychomagian Society, but he does join the Universal Brotherhood for a very brief period of time, as does Smith. But Russell soon neglects his connections with the UB because he's constantly debating the instructional material with his superior, which in this case is also Jones again, under a different name, different magical name, that is. In light of the logical contradictions that he sees in the lessons and how they contradict with what he's learned about Thelemic principles and the AA and the OTO, he decides that he wants to leave. So Russell begins concentrating more on his Caranzon Club's material and his building up his curriculum, and moves to the Detroit area. And he continues to work there, and then shortly after begins writing magazine articles starting around 1930 in May for the Occult Digest and Cosmic Dawn. Those magazine articles are on the website. I think some of them are linked. Yeah, in fact, they're all linked as little articles on the contents page of the website if you go and look. So he continues to build up his curriculum of his own system, which includes work on logic, tantra, ceremonial magic, mathematics, and especially centering around the Yi Jing. The initiatory grades are similar to those of the OTO and the AA, you know, ranging from neophyte on up. He continues writing these magazine articles and sets himself up as the secretary of the Caranzon Club and begins forming other branches, or what he called neighborhoods, throughout Chicago, Detroit, Boston, New York, Denver, Los Angeles, and other places. And about this time, Lewis T. Culling becomes the head of what they call the neighborhood primate of the San Diego body, or the neighborhood. In between all of this, Russell is continuing to write to Crowley and say, look, I'm trying to promote the sales of your books here in the U.S. Although they weren't part of the Caranzon Club curriculum, they were a peripheral part that he promoted to his members. Well, eventually what ends up happening is that Russell writes to Crowley
and says, look, I have all of these students now that I'm promoting the work with. And he says, as a matter of fact, in his letter, he says, I now have 152 members in my club working to establish the law. So Russell is trying to promote not only his own system, but he's promoting Crowley's work and Thelema in general. Russell continues to recommend the books until we get to the point where there's a break with Crowley. And this is about 1935 when Crowley writes a general letter from London to denounce Russell's efforts and accuses him of, you know, basically diverging from the work. Eventually, this leads to a break with Crowley, because Crowley, just more or less because of Russell's hasty departure from Cefalù, I think it left sort of a wound on Crowley, and there was never really that rift never really healed completely. But the thing is that Russell was a very faithful student of Crowley's and continued to apply the Book of the Law as one of his key texts throughout the rest of his life in his own work. So shortly after this rift appears with Crowley, Russell replaces the Shi Yi that Crowley has written with his own original verse of the Yi Ching called Book Chameleon. Around 1936, Russell realizes that he has some problems internally in his own organization, the GBG, and begins expelling people because they're spies.
One thing real quick, I want to clarify. The Karanzan Club and the GBG are the same thing?
Yes, they are. Okay. The Karanzan Club was sort of a germinal version of the GBG.
And GBG stands for?
The GBG stands for the Gnostic Body of God.
Okay.
And the CC, of course, is the Karanzan Club.
Okay. So let's continue. So Russell is now expelling people, and you said this
Russell
was 36, 1936?
Right. He's expelled Ray Burlingame and some other folks, and isolates Lewis Culling from any further participation in the GBG in 1936. By 1937, Russell leaves Chicago and begins setting up his GBG in, first, I believe, Denver, and then later in Los Angeles, and continues writing his own material, which centers around the logic material, the Yi Ching, and some of his other works that are published, which would be like the Tropermic Calculus and on into the projective geometry material, which is much later. So for the rest of his magical career, actually the rest of his life, Russell produced these instructions for his students and continued working in his own vein, dealing with the Yi Ching, mathematics, the projective geometry, and divination, and magical rituals, all based on his early work with Crowley and, you know, kind of inspired from that.
Well, let's take a look at some of the material that he worked with. If we could break it down into a few categories, like there's the Yi Ching divination that you were talking about before with the Book of the Chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
You were also talking about his logic, mathematics, and some other things. So let's kind of break those down and talk about how those are covered through Russell's system. And since you've mentioned the Yi or the Yi Ching a lot, let's start there. What is the Book of the Chameleon, and how is it different than the Yi Ching from the ancient Chinese version and from what Crowley was working with?
Okay. Well, the similarities with Crowley's version of the Yi are that they both have original rhyming verses. In other words, all of the, if you look at the Shi Yi, Crowley's version, and you look at the Book Chameleon, you'll see a similarity in that all of the Yang lines rhyme together and all of the Yin lines rhyme together. So there's a rhyming verse between yins and yangs, you know, all the yins, all the yangs. Book Chameleon is the name of Russell's Yi Ching versage that he did. It's kind of a transformation of the original spirit of the Yi Ching, actually. It's not based on Crowley's work so much as it's based on the spirit of the original Yi. Russell points out that although the Yi is known as a classic of changes, it is the book of changes, that it's remarkable that so little change or evolution happened in its form or commentary. So what Russell's doing in the book Chameleon is basically transforming the Yi to bring it in harmony with the spirit of our times.
And when you say the spirit of our times, do you mean in particular Thelema?
Well, Thelema and just the zeitgeist in general.
Okay.
But yes, mainly Thelema, because what he's doing is he's importing Thelemic values into the advice and versification of the Yi Ching. The thing that's really interesting to note about divinatory work with the Yi Ching is, you know, almost everybody's familiar with it, at least a little bit, probably. But I think there's a general tendency to treat it like an occult version of the magic eight ball, you know, to ask it questions and to expect it to give you, like, am I going to get my new car, you know, or am I going to get laid this weekend, you know, and it's really not designed for that. The real point of it is to pay attention to the advice that the Yi is giving you, and it will aid you in trying to discover the truth of what is going on in and around your own life in the reality of now. It's not to oversimplify, but to use kind of a good example, when you get up in the morning and you turn on the news and you look at the weather, you're relying on the expertise or the advice of a meteorologist who obviously has greater knowledge of the conditions and possible changes that are going to occur throughout the day. Well, much like that, the Yi can be seen kind of like a weather map, like a weather chart. But you have to remember that while you're getting this advice, the important thing is to remember that you have to remain reliant on your own abilities to interpret what the advice is and look at the factors that are likely to influence and affect you in the context of the question you're asking. You see what I mean?
Yes.
Okay. Well, for another reference to Yi Ching divinatory work, if you look in Magic and Theory and Practice, it's very much complementary with what Russell's attempting here. It's in Chapter 18, Part 4 of Magic and Theory and Practice, where Crowley notes just how valuable the Yi Ching is as a divinatory and initiatory tool. And I would recommend that your listeners tip a glance at that section for some possible perspectives on where Russell was going with that.
Okay. Well, let's move on into the logic or reasoning. I think that's a wonderful thing that Russell does, is he stresses the place of logic and reasoning, especially at the beginning of the system. I don't think enough practitioners see the importance of having good logical, critical thinking capabilities.
Oh, I agree. I think it's really important. In fact, it's probably some of the really basic foundational work that should come in order to progress further in a real balanced and sane way, you know. But, you know, the way Russell approached logic was that he taught his students not only to think critically and apply logic properly and appropriately, but he also wanted his students to test his ideas and come to their own conclusions. And, you know, so as a teacher, Russell acknowledged the need to learn through success as well as from making mistakes and learning to correct them. The work that he focused on with the logic material is called Barber Cubed. There's a little bit of that on the website if you want to look. The logical model in Barber Cubed is basically a three-dimensional aid for looking at how the different parts of a logical syllogism interact from all the possible viewpoints and examining the kinds of contradictions that result from any given premise or any choice that you make. So it's teaching you to look at the ramifications of your thought process and the decisions and the choices that you make, the conclusions you come to. So by training your mind to think in a clear and precise way, which is what Russell is doing, the laws of logic are applied in the service of your will, while rooting out any kind of hindrance that might be there that causes confusion and can block you from attaining true knowledge. The thing that's great also about Russell's instructions to his students was he was really trying to push them toward greater states of awareness, he was ultimately trying to push them towards an experience with their HGA in all of this, in all of his instructional material. He was constantly challenging his students. So by that same token, Russell's work is also, in itself, an ongoing dialogue with his own genius.
Well, let's move into another area. Following the logic, Russell gets into some mathematical computations also. Can you expand on this? And now some people will look at themselves and say, oh, well, I don't do well with math, or what does math have to do with spirituality, and all of those kind of things, or math is tedious or boring or whatever.
Well, some people do look at it as kind of dry or tedious. Ignoring the influence of mathematics is like ignoring the laws of gravity. You know, sure, you can get through life without understanding gravity, but we are still subject to it nonetheless, you know. Most people enjoy things like aesthetics, since the opinions you express are pretty much up to your own choice, your own free will. You know, whether you like grilled halibut better than poached salmon, or whether a Rembrandt is better than, a Dalí. This is because, you know, aesthetics is a way of thinking that makes creative use of recipes or rules, with the objective being to express your opinion or debate them. On the other hand, what makes mathematics so distinct from this is it's a method of thought that makes use of archetypal rules that are towards some undefined creative objective. If the fact that the angles of a triangle sum to 180 degrees, for instance, or 3 times 3 is 9, are revealed to you, it's something that you know inwardly, and it's not necessarily something that the external world reveals to you any more deeply than your inner understanding does. So education through mathematics is a very useful tool, since it can, you know, be understood and tested or not independently.
Right, and so it's the objective nature of it that allows kind of a underlying foundation or communication means.
It's not just the objective nature, it's also the accuracy and the precision to which you can begin to hone your thinking. You're beginning to hone your... Russell was trying to get his students to become very one-pointed about their reasoning and their thinking, you know, so that they were fully conscious while they were doing these exercises, so that they're not only expanding the boundaries of their worldview, but also of their self-knowledge by mastering these challenges.
Now, was the math a means towards this end, or was the math also an end in itself?
No, it is a means towards an end. It's basically, again, he's pushing his students towards greater states of awareness to basically, he's presenting them with pushing them as hard as he can, challenging them as much as he can, with something that is going to bring them to a higher state of one-pointedness. It's worth noting that, you know, a lot of things, the more challenging a thing is to achieve, the more it is truly worth knowing.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how deeply do you want to inwardly know things in your lifetime? And I kind of look at the mathematics work and the logic work, all of his instructions, as yoga work involved in precise logic and math, because these are very powerful forces for determining how they're put to the service of your will.
Okay. Well, let's move forward into another area that you might call Russell's theology.
Mm-hmm.
How does he, what is his underlying theological approach to thelema and incorporating things such as the I Ching and logic, mathematics, and so forth?
One of the interesting elements about Russell's system is the way he mates the I Ching with some of the Gnostic mythos, and it's almost like a Manichaean sort of Gnostic mythos, where there's these opposing forces of Lucifer and Ahriman are in constant struggle to impede or control the evolution of, or the apotheosis of, the human spirit.
Now wait, is Lucifer in this instance a positive force, and Ahriman from Zoroastrianism the negative force? Or is that too simplified?
They're similar to the Manichaean or Zoroastrian, I think, from what I understand anyway. But to be a little more specific, what Russell considers the Luciferic forces are those which impair further spiritual progress by ossifying the human spirit, keeping it in the past. In other words, everything has to remain the way it was, or as Russell says, preserved like so many dry mummies. And he says that's the way the Yi was, that it needed to be revivified. Whereas the Aramaic forces are constantly trying to contain the human spirit and keep it in a state of conflict for the future. It's a sacrifice of everything in the past and the present for the sake of the future. It's a hyper-rational and sort of selfish intellect of what Russell calls a machine-like intelligence. He talks about both of these, the Luciferic and the Aramaic forces. He talks about it in his book, Chameleon.
Okay.
But what the central part that balances these two forces is that each human has the ability for liberation from these forces as they come to self-knowledge and inwardly identify themselves with the great work and with their own will. So through this, they're able to enact their own free will. In other words, they're exercising their ability to push the great work further. So the balancing forces between these two extremes emanates from kind of an occult initiatory power of free will and deeds that humankind has to align itself with and then devote those qualities to achieving the great work.
Okay. How does Russell kind of incorporate the full self? I mean, some of the things that you've been talking about, they seem very intellectual. What are the other aspects of kind of the emotional aspects of that?
I see what you're saying. I mean, you know, a lot of it does focus on things that probably people feel are calculative. You know, they center around math and logic and things like this. And what you have to realize is that there's another side to Russell's work. There's an artistic side, but everything that Russell did, he always made his students work with physical models of the concepts. He always grounded them in reality.
Okay.
He never just went off into these abstract mathematical concepts without some sort of real tangible and physical work that the students could do with the math and the logic, because there's no better way to learn than through direct experience, right? So while he had the students working with the hexagrams, for instance, he had them building block working sets, which are 64 blocks that represent the hexagrams. Or he had them doing Chinese calligraphy of the Yi lines, you know, while they were studying the Yi. Or he had them painting watercolor illustrations of the instructional themes, you know, or building one of his books, he focuses strictly on building little handmade computers in a book called The Electrocombinational Engineering.
So what, little computers?
Yeah, they're little handmade computers, but this was before computers were the advent of computers, really.
So is it kind of like more closely related to an abacus, or?
It's sort of an electronic extension of an abacus, really. And he was also having the students do things like hand write out the Book of the Law to ingrain its contents into the student. He had them keep magical records of their workings. You know, so he was, not only was he giving them instructions to work with, but he expected to be able to look at their results and to test them on their results before they could move on to the next grade of work.
All right, well, since you're talking about testing the results and so forth, what kind of exercises or other kind of testing would he do? You've talked about taking the blocks and making the block. You've gone into all of that kind of stuff. Would they submit pictures of their blocks, or would they... they're going to be making these things, but how would he evaluate that?
There was a lot of in-person instruction.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the instructions were sent out to the different neighborhoods or the different areas for his students to read and to study, and they were supervised by the head of their group. The group head would report back to Russell, and in some cases, Russell would visit these different neighborhoods and give them oral instructions, or if they were having difficulties, he would demonstrate his principles. You know, he would sit and demonstrate how to do these things, or he would test them and correct them where they were wrong, you know, so that they say, oh, okay, well, I get it now. You know, I obviously
right.
made a mistake here, and now I understand, so that they can push on with the work. He wasn't leaving them exclusively to their own devices. You know, he was pushing them all the time to continue working.
Okay. Well, I think this is a good little overview. How did you get involved with Russell?
The way I started with the Russell material was basically through just some Xerox copies that I had gotten of Barber Cubed and Znoose's Knees, Volumes 1 through 3, which are his memoirs, in 1996. So shortly after that, I began keeping a separate magical journal of my work and readings, my impressions of the GBG stuff. So by fall of that same year, I started to map out the 3D cube and the logic material from Book Chameleon, and I built a hand-painted wooden model, just like he expected his students to, of the Chameleon Cube and used it as a study aid. About that same time, I decided to start the website, which is still a evolving work in progress, and it's a repository for some parts of you know, my work with reading this stuff. The GBG material really interested me. It really did. It really grabbed me. And in the next level of Russell's work with the tropermic calculus, and I also became aware of the projective geometry work that Russell did later on in his life, I came across one book called Blooming Umbrella that I saw from Keith 418, our friend. And this book primarily dealt with a geometrical analysis of the tree of life. Now, while my daytime job deals with geometry and math a lot, there was quite a bit of nomenclature and sort of analytical geometry terms that I wasn't really familiar with or wasn't really prepared to digest in that work without going back through all the preliminaries and building up on all the proper links first. So I began looking at some of the earlier material and went back to the tropic algorithm stuff from tropermic calculus and added that to the website, and also constructed, again, my own wooden models of the tablocks to work with as I went through the book. After that, I kind of moved into the looking at the Yi Ching stuff and the block working material that you mentioned just a while ago. The block working material is basically 64 little blocks that all represent the 64 hexagrams. They're stacked into a cube. You can see pictures of them on the website. There's two different versions. There's the Roman version that I first did just to work on that. I've had to build the tools. I had to build these block working sets, and that took me about 9.5 months of solid work for 2 to 3 hours a day.
Wow.
A considerable amount of work.
Just to make the 64 blocks?
Right.
Wow.
Every face of 64 blocks, so that's 384 faces, and they're all fairly detailed.
You were painting on each face?
That's correct.
Wow, yeah.
That's correct. I was doing them according to Russell's instructions, because that's part of what he's trying to do is he's not just saying, here are the tools, use them. He's saying, make the tools and you will understand the concepts better. He wants you to directly experience the material through really working with it in every aspect.
So also while you're constructing it, I guess you're also meditating on the various symbols and the yi and,
sure,
and the meaning behind it. And by you're getting that whole body integration. It's not just this mental thing. You're painting. It's very tactile.
Right.
Have to concentrate. So you've got that focus and
right.
And kind of it's all encompassing.
I see it as kind of a yoga work, because not only was I doing the physical work with my hands, but I was also, my mind was fully engaged with the material as well by doing the astral work with the yi at the same time, and like you said, I'm just working with it in every aspect, which is exactly what Russell wanted his students to encounter with the work.
Okay.
I was also working on developing the logical square of the hexagrams for the website around then, too.
So not only were you doing this physically in the wood, you were also doing a lot of this kind of work in the website, too.
That's correct, and I was doing astral work with the yi at the same time.
So once you've completed your blocks, where did you go from there?
Well, I went back to finish up the tropermic calculus stuff that I had started on the website and basically got to a point with the tropic algorithm where I understood it well enough and I felt like, well, okay, I can explain this on the website. So I went through that and picked up one of his other books called Combinational Arithmetic, which is some early combinatorial math, which is used in other places throughout his teaching. And kind of went through that really quickly just to fill in a gap in my knowledge, you know. His work is so multifold. There's so many different aspects to it that the way all of these different aspects link together is really important. He's very lucid in the way that he links each thing to the next thing. It's very careful. It's very methodical. And I was very aware the entire time I was working with the Russell material to pay attention to that, because I thought, well, if there's any point where he's not following through on something that he's indicating, I'm going to be able to spot it. And frankly, I never did find anything to that effect. I was able to see just how consistent it was and how lucid and logical it all was. It was very progressive. So from there, I started looking at some of the early Karanzon Club material and how it relates to Russell's AA and OTO work, and started looking at his history and the things that we've already talked about at the beginning of the show here. And I also added some sampling of some hand-painted pictures called Tai Shu as examples of some of his artistic work. Because, you know, not only was he doing all of this logical work, like I said, he was also encouraging his students to not only to think, but to feel and will. These are the three aspects of the cube. The thinking, the feeling, and the willing were the three major principles that he was trying to get his students attuned to and to excel in.
Right, and he actually kind of represented those as three axes in a three-dimensional space.
Right, they're the three axes of the cube. The thinking is the vertical axes, the up and down axes. Feeling is the forward and backward axes of the cube, and willing is the left to right axes of the cube, or the right to left, whichever. So after I did some more work with just looking at the historical stuff and some of his early work, started looking at Russell's other variants of the hexagrams and went back to doing some more Yi Ching work like I had done previously and built another block set. And this block set took me approximately about 3 months of solid work, or about 2 to 3 hours a day again. So, but just between building the blocks for these two exercises, that's a year, that's about a year's worth of just solid work, just physical work and, you know, astral work, yoga work, meditation, all that put together.
That's very impressive.
Well, it's something I really was attracted to, and I was drawn to it, and I related to it on such a basic level that it seemed like the right way to approach the material. It seemed like a very instinctively correct way to approach the Yi as he has it drawn up. So I continued doing a little bit more Yi Ching work and divinatory work, and started practicing the Chinese brushwork material by writing the Yi lines using his variant of Chinese he calls Ming, and practiced that for a while and got somewhat familiar with it. And in the meantime, I started to look at some of his other instructions that he did, and really, like I said, I began to appreciate the scope of his life's great work and how everything he produced was so lucidly related to all the other elements in his instructions.
Well, you're also an artist yourself, right?
That's right.
I've seen some of your artwork. It's very nice. You do airbrush and some other painting techniques. Have you incorporated some of this work in your own artwork?
Sure. Yeah, I actually did some figurative pieces earlier this year, or actually the beginning of last year, that are sort of loosely inspired on some of the concepts that I sort of absorbed through Russell's material. So I really felt like kind of giving that an artistic expression in my own work, and it was very inspiring. And I want to do some more of that and share it with other people for not only my own enjoyment, but for theirs. You know, while I haven't built some of those handmade computers that we talked about, I would really like to build one of those, too. That's something I really want to try. I have to mention that, you know, I've been talking about the website, too.
Right.
A lot of the website work that I've done over the past 10 years with the Russell material is done in parallel in cooperation with our friend Keith 418.
Mm-hmm.
He's been very, very supportive of what I've done. He's offered some great critique and constructive advice. And not only that, he has really good background knowledge of Russell's magical work. And I'm very, very grateful for that. I also have the support of my friends at fastblogit.com for hosting some of the Russell material and helping the website that I have continue to evolve. They've been very supportive of me as well, and I want to thank them. And also, I really want to thank Ben Fernie at Caduceus Books for offering the published Russell work in his catalog for sale now.
Right. Let's spend a few moments on that.
Okay.
You have worked with the Russell Estate,
mm-hmm,
to get many of the works that Russell had published available for sale, and Ben at Caduceus is handling the sales of those books,
right,
correct?
Right, he is. He's been very helpful with advice on the market, you know, and just general book-selling skills that probably most of us aren't that adept at as much as he is, and offered to sell the Russell-published material in his catalogs now, and as a result, result of that, what we did was we wrote up, my friends at fastblogger.com wrote up chapter descriptions for each of those books, and there's links that you can go to from the contents page on the Russell site to look at kind of what each of those books is about. But Ben has been very, very helpful with all of this, and I hope that people will look at the Russell material and really check it out.
All the books that we've been mentioning, Book Chameleon, Barbara Cube,
right?
Hermit
Calculus.
Zunu, how do you pronounce that? Zunu's Knees?
Zunu's Knees, which is his, those are his memoirs, basically.
Right.
That's where he really tells it all like it is, you know. He tells his side of the story of everything that happened between he and Crowley, between everything that went on from the beginning of his life to probably about the late 1970s. You know, he let the chips fall where they may. He told the truth and gives his side of the story. So I think the Zunu's Knees are very interesting from a historical point of view, as well as getting another perspective on Russell as a student of Crowley and his relationship with Crowley and with Thelema and with his own work, you know. It gives you a good overview of the body of his work, all of the stuff that he did with his students. Gives you a pretty good exposure to all of that.
Now, you've been a practicing magician and Thelemite for almost 2 decades now. How has the Russell work been incorporated, or how has it enhanced your work in a totalizing effect? It's the way you talk about it, it's not kind of this thing that you do on the weekends or this kind of segmented thing. So how has it really manifested in your life in the last decade?
I was really interested in the logic material, and I felt like that was something that was a really good preliminary for every magician to kind of look at as a foundational type of material. Like I said earlier, it really gives you a good grounding in critical thinking, and it balances your work. So throughout the time that I was really getting into the Russell material, I sort of saw Russell's work as a natural extension of the Thelemic magic that Crowley wanted his students to produce.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this is sort of Russell taking the Crowley material and continuing on in his own vein. And Russell's work encompasses, you know, the entire length of his life. He never stopped producing and publishing material. The entire process was going on until the end of his life in 1987. So I consider him a real devoted Thelemic magic as well as a teacher. From an artistic standpoint, I really appreciated the beauty of his methods and how that reflected in the outer aesthetics of the cube work and the paintings and the other artistic work. If you look at the pictures on the website, you'll see what I'm talking about. As an engineering student, I sort of appreciated the careful and systematic way that he makes each part of the instructions link to the next with complete continuity and lucidity. You know, there was no gap. And I guess lastly, as a Thelemite, I really enjoyed the way Russell was developing his own magical system and how much disciplined yoga work was involved in applying his teachings. So when you look at Russell's life from not just the external events, all the history that we've talked about and the things that are going on in his life, you know, during his lifetime, but you also look at how closely he realized his inner purpose, the inner life that he was carrying on, and look at that in the context of the great works, it's evident that Russell didn't really diverge much from his real purpose. I think that's a great credit to Crowley. You know, I think Crowley really ingrained the Thelemic values into Russell. So he continued to modify and improve and expand his knowledge throughout his entire lifetime. And as a result of that, and as part of the process, he became a great teacher to learn from. So really, I still fondly regard Russell as one of Crowley's most productive magical pupils. And I think it's really worth looking at his material in that light.
What would you be recommending as the first books that someone should get?
I think the first book that people should really look at is not only Book Chameleon, but his memoirs, if they're interested in that particular aspect, but also the Barber Cubed, because that's the logic work. That's where the whole thing starts. That's the basis of the work.
So again, Barbara Cubed, Zunu's Knees.
Zunu's Knees, yeah.
And then
that's
Book
the
Chameleon.
Memoirs. It's called Zunu's Knees, The Memoirs of a Magician.
Okay. And Ben has all of those in stock.
He does. I believe he has all of those in his catalog for sale. And in addition, if you look at the contents page of the website, there are some links to some descriptions of those. If you're wanting to check out a little bit about them, you can either look at Ben's catalog or those links.
Well, fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you being on the show. I don't think enough people are familiar with what C.F. Russell was doing and the work that he did his whole life, as well as the organization. So
yeah,
this may be the first time that many people have heard about Russell,
mm-hmm.
other than in a tangential aspect of him being at Cefalu or
right.
have been a student of Crowley. So I really appreciate you taking the time and coming on the show.
Well, you're very welcome. You know, Russell was right in the thick of all this. He was right there with Crowley and Jones and everyone else during that time period. So I think it's important that people look at him as well.
Well, great. And people, if they have questions for you, can get in touch with you through the website?
Sure. They can get in touch with me through the website, or if they have questions that they want to ask, you know, I'll be happy to answer them.
All right. What email address should they use?
Chameleon@iCyberMind. That's iCyberMind.net.
All right, and that will go straight to you?
That'll come to me, and that's the address I use primarily for selling the book Chameleon, which is used to, the funds from that are used to support the website.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome, John. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
93.
Thanks again to Breck for being on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time. I think that was one of the best interviews that has been on the show because it covers a broad topic, but it was very organized and methodical, and a lot of that is due to Breck and the way he approaches the material. So thanks to Breck and for all of your time and being on the show. As in the past, Thelema Coast to Coast, in conjunction with Latex Records, is giving away the catalog of Latex Records. We still have 3 CDs left. Written in Ashes, which was on the last show, will be given away. And the winner of the Written in Ashes CD is Jenny, and she lives in New Zealand. So congratulations, Jenny. I'll be getting the CD out to you shortly. There are 2 more CDs to be given away. One is from the band I'll be playing today, Kali Yuga. I've played a few of their songs before, but this one is going to be for the giveaway of the Kali Yuga CD, and the song I'm going to be playing of theirs is a cover of the Misfits song, London Dungeon, and I really like this album a lot. I've listened to it a number of times, and I'm sure whoever gets it will be really happy with it. The last album that I'll be giving away is called Primal River Valley, and it is a double CD. So anybody listening who wants the Kali Yuga or the double CD from Latex Records, please send an email to podcast@ThelemaCoastToCoast and put CD giveaway in the subject and put your civil name and mailing address in the email, and I will randomly pick 1 person per show and give those CDs away. Please note that this giveaway is open to everybody in the world. As you just heard, Jenny in New Zealand won, and I'll be sending her the CD. There is no cost or anything, just send an email. Okay, one last reminder. Thelema Coast to Coast is broadcast through streaming on the Pagan Radio Network, and that's at paganradio.net. It used to be called Circle of Souls Pagan Radio, but now it is at paganradio.net. Thelema Coast to Coast is broadcast at Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and that can be adjusted for whatever time zone you're at. This is streaming radio, and when they're not doing various podcasts that they broadcast, during the day, they usually do pagan and folk, new age, world fusion kind of music. And then Friday and Saturday nights, they do gothic, ethereal, dark wave, industrial, dark pagan, and things like that. So if you go to the paganradio.net site, you can look at the listings and see when they're going to be broadcasting the music. They have all of the time zones covered. So I encourage you to go check it out. It's pretty good music. Anyway, that takes care of show number 29. I hope you all have enjoyed it, and stick around for show 30. Love is the law, love under will.